Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, 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 and welcome to episode 4 of the Starting Line podcast with me, Rich Lee, where we'll continue to talk to amazing people with incredible stories, and today's is absolutely no different. But before we get onto that, I need to speak about the fantastic week we've just had, an absolutely mind-blowing week in which I think anybody that's ever made a podcast can attest to the fact that you become quite addicted quite quickly to checking the charts, to looking at how things are doing, and I was looking at the Apple podcast charts. This podcast comes under business, society and culture, self-improvement, various other kind of categories as you upload a podcast. And I think it's quite fun actually to bring some of you along with me on the journey of creating a podcast, especially those of you following on the social media channels. I went onto each of those categories. I was thinking, oh, it'd be amazing to be in the top 200 of business. Yeah, we're only 2 weeks in. It'd be incredible to see, but you know, not expecting anything. And so what I did is I scrolled all the way down to the 200th podcast, and then I scrolled up. And I thought, yeah, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then I got to the top 100, kept scrolling, and I saw the Starting Line podcast in there at 72. Number 72 in the world, the 72nd best listened to business podcast in the world. And then I kept looking. Every day I'd look. And we got to 63 in the charts, which is just phenomenal. And essentially that means that we're pushing towards the top 50. So Stephen Bartlett, I've got my eye on you. Where's that crown? Thank you for sharing, listening, reviewing. That's the thing I think that makes the most difference is the reviews. So thank you for all of the 5-star reviews, both on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. The more people we can get this out to, the more people can listen to it. And the fantastic guests we've had. Let's not forget, we've had Levi Roots. We've had Marnie Swindles, the Apprentice winner from this year. We've had James Cracknell, OBE. His episode has just absolutely flown. It's a phenomenal conversation with a just inspiring man. And the other two have just been phenomenal as well. And, you know, success begets success. Somebody comes along, they listen to that one, they listen to another one, they subscribe. It's wonderful. So thank you very, very much. I just want to get this out to as many people as possible. What I wanted to do with this podcast, and I've been talking about doing this, anybody that's listened to other episodes knows that I've been talking about doing this for a long time. And 10 years, I've got notes from 2012, 2013, where I'm talking about the kind of guests I'd like to have on, the kind of things I want to be talking about. And I'm really glad that I didn't do it then, because now with 35, I'm that bit older. I've got that much more experience and contacts and all of those things. But one thing I want to do is put my home city of Gloucester on the map. If you ask anybody what they know of Gloucester, it's usually a handful of things. The rugby team, love Gloucester rugby. They'll talk about maybe the cheese rolling, which is where some insane people chase cheese down a 1-1 hill and the winner gets the cheese and everybody else gets a broken leg. They might talk about Harry Potter in the cathedral. because some of Harry Potter was filmed in Gloucester Cathedral. Or they'll talk about Fred West and Rose West. And the less said about that, the better. So I think, I've loved this city. There are some incredible people doing amazing things. And there have been for a long time. And I just think sometimes this city, we're quite downcast, we're quite negative. And there can be a real feeling of, oh, it's just, Gloucester, Cheltenham's better, etc. Now, for anybody outside of Gloucestershire, outside of the UK, that wouldn't mean very much to you. But Cheltenham's where the races happen. It's quite an affluent area compared to Gloucester, it being its kind of poorer cousin. You've got, as I say, some amazing people that have done some incredible things from here. For instance, one of the people I talked to in this very series, so he'll be coming up soon, a guy called Christian Leroy Duncan. And Christian was a Cage Warriors middleweight champion, defended the title. And the Cage Warriors is effectively the feeder competition to the UFC. Anybody into mixed martial arts will know the UFC is like the Premier League. And I guess, I don't think it's a disservice to say Cage Warriors is effectively the championship. And I think that's a really, really good way of saying he was the very best in Cage Warriors, middleweight champion, as I say. And he's fought in the UFC now. And he'll just walk around Gloucester and people won't necessarily even look at him, know who he is. I want to change that. I want to say, listen, we've got a UFC fighter from Gloucester. And that brings me to, that's an episode to listen to. That's an episode to watch out for. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal conversation. Christian is a credit to the city, a credit to the sport, just an incredibly humble, sensitive. You wouldn't think it for somebody that gets in an octagon and punches people for a living, but just an incredible guy. And that is a very nice segue to Shabir Haidery. Shabir fled Afghanistan age 12. He ended up in Gloucester after an incredibly long and tumultuous journey and something, frankly, I wouldn't want to wish on my worst enemy. He has had 5 professional fights. He's won every single one. He's got his 6th fight coming up on September 30th. If you go to Shabir's social media pages, then you can find details of how to go to that fight. He's just been granted British citizenship, which is incredible. I've known Shabir again for getting on 10 years now. I watched his first ever amateur fight, as we talk about in the episode, and you could see then he had something incredibly special. This episode, as I say, is to shine a light on the city, to bring this city behind him, to bring people all over the world behind Shabir, because he's a phenomenal talent, and he'll be on his way to his 6th win on the 30th of September, and then no doubt onto bigger things. The world, he wants to be world champion, and you listen to this and tell me that you'd bet against that happening. Given that Gloucester feels like something of an underdog city, there are definite parallels with Philadelphia. It's an easy comparison to make. But here we have our very own Rocky Balboa in Shabir Haidery. To follow this show on social media, that's at Starting Line Show on Instagram and TikTok, at Starting Line Show without the W on Twitter. And to find out more about the podcast and me, go to startinglinepod.com. For Facebook, for those of you still using Facebook, and there are a good few of you, just search for the Starting Line Podcast. So without further ado, I bring to you my powerful, emotional conversation with Shabir Haidery. Shabir, hello, mate.
Hi, Rich.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for coming in to do this. I think you are on a great run right now. Is it 5-0?
5-0, it is indeed.
5-0 professionally. How many amateur fights?
I've had 18 amateur fights, although I should have had a lot more. But due to injury, plus I had schooling and other personal stuff, that kind of set me back. But I was always fighting people who's had 50 fights, 100 fights, 100 amateur fights. So I was always up against it.
Did you know that you wanted to be a pro boxer as soon as you walked into the gym or...?
The first day I walked into the gym, I mean, I tried kickboxing, I tried wrestling, I tried a bit of everything, MMA, taekwondo, karate, everything. But I just never found anything that like gave me that adrenaline, that buzz or that energy. And then remember the first day walking into a boxing gym, Fight Factory, and straight away they kind of, we were doing some drill, just countering the jab. And then from the very first day, I was getting hit in the face and I just fell in love with it.
That's amazing. So you trying all the other ones, that was before boxing. So taekwondo, yeah. And all of those things. So you knew you wanted to do something in the combat kind of sport?
Yeah, I always had something in me that just wanted to do that. I just didn't know how to channel my energy or how to channel that. I was a lost soul.
Really?
Until I found boxing. Yeah.
What made you, do you think, want to kind of pursue combat sport?
It wasn't like I wasn't particularly looking to do a combat sport, although I did like fighting or all the rough stuff. I always did, but I just didn't know what to do and what I'm going to stick to. And also plus the opportunity I'm going to get. And I think boxing was just at the right time, the right opportunity. And I think it just it gave me that right energy that I needed.
How old were you when you first started boxing?
14. I was 14, yeah.
So you'd been in Gloucester a couple of years by that point. Is that right?
I was in Gloucester almost a year, I think. I was here, just more than a year probably.
Amazing. So your fight at the weekend, that was your second fight in 2 weeks. How are you feeling after that?
I mean, I haven't got a bruise. My face is as good as it was when I entered the ring. Everything is fine apart from my hands, just a little bit sore, just because fighting two fights in 2 weeks, especially professional fights. I mean, even the amateur guys don't do it.
It's kind of unheard of.
It's very, very unheard of. Even the amateurs, they don't fight twice in 2 weeks. And I said, look, I want to fight, you know, regardless, just because my last fight got cancelled. So I just thought, I want to catch up. I don't want to fall behind. I want to get to those titles as quick as possible, even if it costs me, even if I have to put money from my own pocket. Like, I didn't really care. I just wanted to fight. So that's why both of the fights were booked in. And I said, let's go for it.
I love it. For a lot of people that listen to this, boxing seems quite complex. All the weight divisions, all the belts. Of course, we all know you're Anthony Joshua's. Everybody knows the big names, but boxing's hard to make a name in. What is the route from amateur through to, we're talking about titles, how do you go from boxing in Fight Factory at your local gym to winning a world title?
I mean, for most, the most important thing is in boxing that you can box.
Yeah.
That's it. You need to kind of tick that box, and then you can also fight and you can take a punch. These are kind of the three fundamentals that you need to have to succeed in this boxing career. And I think so far I'm yet to find out that myself. Like, I know I can fight, I know I can box. My trainer has put people in front of me, top prospects and all those top level boys, and I've been sparring them and I've yet to be tested. So I feel like, although they think that it is a test for me, but I haven't found that test yet, so I'm still looking for it. And as of boxing, starting in your local gym, starting from zero to potentially winning a world title, is a continuous dedication, training, fight as much as you can in amateur, get as much experience as you can. Once you've had all your amateur experience, then you need, obviously, you need a professional boxing coach who's going to take you to that next step, who's going to guide you through your career. And that's not good enough. You also need the backing of your friends, your family, your local community, plus your city, you know, your town. And, you know, if you haven't got the backing of that when you're starting off from a local gym, it's very hard to make it to the top, just because every time you fight, you have to cover all these different costs. You have to pay for your manager, you have to pay your coach, you have to pay the promoter, you have to pay your opponent when you start off, and then you're the last person to get paid. So it's not easy, but I mean, you know what they say, if it was easy, everyone would have done it. So that's why we do it.
That's it. And you fight, what weight do you fight at now?
At the moment, like, I fought at featherweight, 57 kilo. I fought at super featherweight, 59 kilo. My last fight was, I almost fought at 64 kilo. Although I was a lighter, my opponent was a lot heavier. So I fought at lightweight, but I still managed to get the win. Yeah, so it was all good.
How many categories are there? How many weight categories are there?
There's loads. You got a flyweight, super flyweight, bantamweight, super bantamweight, then you have a featherweight, super feather, and then lightweight, super lightweight, and the list keeps going on and on and on. The only the lower category guys are capped at a certain weight, but when you're heavyweight, you can be as big as you want, like Anthony Joshua or Tyson Fury. There is no limit.
Yeah,
you can be as big as you
monsters.
Want. That's it. They're giants. Those guys are. Yeah.
So from here, as I say, 5-0. Where do you go from here?
I've got a very long road ahead. However, I can see my road a little clear. I know I can see the path, but I don't know the bumps what's going to be ahead. From here, I've already spoke to my manager. I've already spoke to my coach, to my team. And I just said, look, I'm going all the way. I can see myself going all the way to the world title. I said, for one moment, if I thought I couldn't do that, that would be the last day of me boxing. I would hang my glove just because boxing is just too hard of a sport to play around with it.
Why would you put yourself through it?
You know, yeah, why would I put myself through it, everything? And just when I start off, like at the moment, boxing is actually costing me money rather than giving me anything back.
So that's funny, because as a professional fighter, as a professional boxer, people would think that you're making money from this, as in, you know, making hopefully good money. You know, you'd hope that with what you put in, training, the camps, the eating perfectly, all of this stuff, the fights themselves, people would hope that you were making money, but you're saying that it costs you.
Oh, absolutely. Like, and even now, it's funny you saying that, when I bump into my friends and all that, and obviously they follow me through social media and they see my fight news and everything, won the fight, and they just carry on, oh, you're a big man now, you've got all the money, all the bucks in your pocket. And I'm thinking, I just go with it. However, it's not like that at the moment. I'm working to fund my training. It's like the training cost. We have to go sparring twice a week. We have to travel to London. We have to travel to Birmingham, Wales. That costs the fuel every time. Every time you go there, it costs you £100 just to go there and back. Plus, on top of that, all the training equipment, you have to get the right gloves, just because that's your tools. You want to make sure your hands are protected. One pair of gloves are 300. Your head guard is about 300. Bollock protector, 300. Plus the clothes you have to get. And then on top of that, the nutrition, the food you need, you have to make sure you get the right food. That costs a lot of money too. Nowadays, it's a lot easier to be unhealthy than actually healthy.
Very
so
true.
It costs double when you're trying to be healthy. And then you have to pay every year. You have to make sure you do medical, boxing medical. It's like, costs you like £1,000 every time. You have to have a brain scan.
But when does a boxer start making money?
Oh, that's the question. That's the golden question. I'm yet to find out myself, just because we've been struggling. However, I think it's when we reach the titles and we get the big promoters looking at us and see, you know, there is potential and they're backing us and saying,
who are the big promoters? Who do you want to take notice of you?
You know, oh, everybody knows Eddie Hearn. You know, Matchroom Boxing, they are the guys at the moment, they run the show. So I would love for them like to kind of come on board and see the potential and give me the opportunity to showcase the world what
I've
got.
All the talent. You know, I was saying to you before this, I'm watching your fights, they all go on YouTube. You can see you're a phenomenal, phenomenal boxer. I know Nassim Hamed is an inspiration for you. I grew up watching Nassim Hamed and thinking, what a man. Did he fight in your weight category?
Yes, he did. He did, actually. Nassim Ahmad, Prince Nassim Ahmad. Oh, he's a great fighter. Absolutely. All credit to him. He was an amazing fighter and his style was very unique.
Phenomenal. Hands down, like, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Crazy.
It was out of ordinary. He's like,
flip, you know, he'd like, you know, flip into the ring or come in on a flying carpet, all of that stuff.
I don't know if I can do that, flip into the ring, but I certainly try all the other stuff, dropping my hands. I mean, I've got people are already comparing me to Prince Nassim Ahmad, but I think my style is completely different. In some ways, it's a similar, but it's in a lot of ways, it's going to be a lot different. I have my own style. It's very unique. I switch. I can box. I can fight. I can drop my hands, you know. It's on the night, you know, whoever they put in front of me, according to that individual and according to the crowd, what they want to see.
Let's talk about that, actually, because I think I see you coming out in your big coat. You love to put on a show. You can see that, you know, for the people that do travel and come and support you. And I know there are many, you know, there are many people you love to put on a show. Do you think that's important in terms of building your profile? You know, is it conscious building your profile enough, you know, within those fights so that people just kind of stand up and take notice? So both inside and outside of the ring?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think it is who I am. You know, what you see inside the ring, this is the guy I am. What you see outside the ring, this is who I am. I don't try to put on something or be somebody that I'm not. Obviously, going into the ring, the reason I box is because I enjoy it. The reason I fight is because I enjoy it. So I make sure every moment and that ring, I cherish.
You really look like you're enjoying it as well. And I love that.
And I do. Like, honestly, I get punched in the face. Even that part, I still love it. You know, every part of it. So when I walk into the ring and when I see all that crowd outside and cheering my name, all the friends and family and fans, it just kind of gives me that extra bit of energy that I need to make sure that whatever show I put on, I make sure it's got that extra spice to it. You know, everybody enjoys it. I put a show on anyway, but because all that crowd, they've come to watch me fight, I spend their hard-earned money to come and watch me fight and make sure their money is worthwhile, you know.
So how do you get to the point of fighting for a title?
We are on the building at the moment. The next fight is going to be an 8-rounder for me. I've already spoke to my manager. I said, look, I want a challenge. Give me somebody who's going to push me, who's going to give me all the different problems they can. And I need a hard fight. I need somebody who can stand with me, fight me, and who can box me. So we've already spoke after this fight, or even this fight, we can get like a title eliminator, which after that, hopefully a southern area, after this fight, a southern area or an English title. That's what at the moment, that's where the talk is. Once I get my English title, then we can go on and get the British, Commonwealth, European.
We touched on it. You came to England when you were 12 from Afghanistan. I know that wasn't the easiest journey for you, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, my journey over here, when people talk about, I'm going away, I'm going to Afghanistan or I'm going to Spain, all we have in our mind is just get a ticket online and go on a plane and be in Spain within the next 4 hours. But my journey wasn't like that. It probably took me almost 8 months to a year. Yeah, we started off, we were on the plane. There was part of the journey that we had to get on the plane. There was part of journey we had to kind of walk for night during the night just to cross the border. There was part of the journey we had to get on the dinghy boat and cross the channel. At any moment, I never thought I could make it. It was in my head, like I could never see it making it. I always thought, oh, I wonder if I make it, or is that it, you know?
Like, is that it?
Like, as in, am I going to survive it?
Did you want to come?
Yes, I did. I didn't know the extent of opportunity, but I, like, it was the dreamland, the heaven, or the land of opportunity. That's what it is. And well, back home, back in Afghanistan, you don't have that. When you get out of your home, you don't know whether you can come back to your house alive. You know, it was like that. And it's not just about, oh, there's all that fighting going on, all that explosion, whether you can make it back alive. There was a lot of kidnapping. People are kind of hungry. They would do anything to kind of feed themselves. So it was dangerous times. There was times we were hungry for days. I've seen stuff as a young child that I shouldn't, but it's made me who I am today.
Do you think that strength of mind is why you're going to succeed as a boxer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, nothing. I've seen so much as a young child that, as I said before, I don't wish any child to go through that, or any underage, any adult to go through it, just because it's horrifying, it's horrific, and it's terrible. But then again, it was almost like in that age when you see something that your mind can't cope with it, you almost kind of go numb to it. And I remember those days, and I think that's what most of the Afghans are. They are numb to that feeling.
I was listening to a podcast with Yeon Mi Park. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's a North Korean defector, they call her. And she was saying similar things about North Korea. But obviously we don't really see much here, know much, you know, about North Korea. But she said some of the things she saw, you just get incredibly numb to, you know, the horror of it. Almost. And I can't imagine. So no, thank you for sharing that. I mean, was there a moment where your family were like, this is the last, you know, this is it. We need to kind of get Shabir out of here.
There was loads of moments, you know, for the whole family. And there still is, you know, like you still worry about your family. You're going to always worry about your family, just because I'm in a safe country. I've got bed to sleep on. I've got family that loves me, got friends and family that looks after me, and we know we're safe. We're kind of striving to achieve, or I'm striving to achieve my dream. But back home, I still got friends and family that I still, when I remember, I think, I wonder what's going to happen to them, or I wonder what future is going to hold for them. You know, is there any future? Yeah, it's one of those. I tend to kind of, right now, I tend to not watch the news much just because of what's happening. And if there is something I can do about that, or if there is something I can change, but if it's out of my hand, and there's no good me kind of moaning and putting myself down about it, or kind of almost ruining my future because me getting a future, me getting to the top of the world or getting that world title, that is a hope for this country in England or UK as a whole, but also at the same time, it's a hope for all those refugees, all those people that kind of got displaced during the war or suffering some sort, and they're struggling to find a way. When they look at me and see what I've achieved through all that hardship, although there's always people that's going to be worse than me, but to some extent, if what I've been through and look at where I am going, I think it's going to kind of give them some sort of hope.
You're called the Afghan warrior. So yeah, you can't fail but to know where you're from. And hopefully, as you say, that reaches people, inspires people. I did see you've trademarked it. You've trademarked the Afghan warrior. I absolutely love that. What are you hoping to do with it?
I trademarked it just because once I get a bit more time and the right support and the right crew with me, I want to turn that into a charity. I want to turn that into like a business and merchandise and all the other stuff. So some of the profit of that company could go and help build a school or build a boxing gym, you know, something for all those orphans back in Afghanistan.
That's incredible. Yeah. You'll get there. I know you will. You absolutely will.
Oh, we will. Absolutely. We will as a team.
I heard you talking once about your trip over. You talked about the dinghy in particular. It's something that we, through the media, see a lot. And people that do have have lived a life of comfort, that haven't had to struggle, that don't know what that feels like, looks like, they see these images of people coming here on boats and all that. And, you know, they might have negative thoughts of them. You want to tell us what it was like?
Oh, it's even kind of sometimes when I see a little clip of people on the dinghy, it gives me that flashback of that night. It's like on the dinghy, you're supposed to sit just five people. But we were sat like about 30, 40 with women, kids, adults. I wasn't a great swimmer, and crossing the channel from Turkey to Greece, it was a very long channel, dark at night, very, very scary. And there was times I've heard so many stories, just there was people that went before us, they kind of drowned and they're, most of them died. In the back of my mind, I just thought, okay, I think this is it. All right. Again, I was numb to it. It was like, I think this might be it, but like, it didn't really faze me in terms of, oh, I'm upset or I'm crying. It's like, oh, if it is what it is, it's going to be, this is what's going to be.
Did you talk? So, like, were you talking on there as you?
The women were crying, kids were crying. There was loads of screams. There was two more babies, but they were like toddlers, younger than me. But like, I was kind of the younger adult or child that was on that dinghy. And as soon as it came, we got to the shore and it was like, oh my God, we're here, you know, and everybody, like, the agent said, oh, you know, you guys need to start jumping and get on the water. So everybody started running, like all the adults. Bear in mind, I was very young. I was only 12. So I was the last to go. And all the women jumped in the water. It was like about 40, 50 meters away from the shore. And the water was the waves were quite heavy as well. So as I was going, you know, trying to get to the shore, it was like one of the women left one of their babies, you know, like a toddler on the dinghy. Everyone else left the dinghy. So it was me and that toddler, and the dad of that toddler took the other baby, took him with him, but he couldn't take both of them. So it was like in the back of my mind, I was thinking, oh, should I take this baby or should I just take care of myself and get to the shore? I don't want to die. It was just a split of a moment. And I just thought, okay, you know what, bugger it. I just grabbed that baby with me and then jumped in the water and tried to get on the shore. And it is a very weird feeling. I never thought we could make it. Even on that moment, I thought, okay, although I seen the parents cross, like it was dark, jump in the water. And I thought they'd probably make make it to the shore. But in the back of my mind, that baby was crying and I had it, and we were just, it was like a bit of a hill, all the rocks and stuff. We had to climb up it, and you just couldn't see anybody. You couldn't see anything, couldn't see anybody. All you could hear was the waves kind of hitting the rocks. And then at that moment, in the back of my mind, I'm kind of thinking, what if this baby's parents die? What are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do to this baby? And I just thought, you know, whatever, I'm just going to say, this is my brother, you know?
Yeah.
And that was literally going through my head on that moment. And that baby was crying, and it was like, and I was running with the baby.
You know? How old are we talking? How old do you think the baby was?
I think it was about probably 16 months to 14 months.
Trivia, that's incredible.
Roughly. It was very scary, and it was kind of, as I was running, like, well, I didn't worry that, oh, should I find the parents? No, we were just running. And as I was going across, and I thought, I was running, and I thought, oh, maybe the parents survived. So I was like, everybody else was running. You couldn't see anything. So got the baby. I started going back, coming backwards towards where we kind of jumped off the dinghy and all the rocks and everything, and the baby were crying. And then from very far away, I could hear the mum screaming. And then I thought, okay, the mum is alive. And then I seen the mum, and from very far away, like, we started running towards her. And then as soon as I seen that she was close enough to see me and seen the baby, I thought, oh, here's your baby. Come on, take it, you know. And then she started running to her baby, and she was like, you could just see the tears and the joy at the same time. And, you know, and
you
it
saved
was like,
a life. You literally saved a life.
I don't know, you know.
You did.
I don't know whether I saved that life or not, but it's just, it was one of those, I kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, super inspiring.
Oh, it's hard to talk about it, man.
I'm sorry. It speaks to who you are. Even if at 12 years old, that's the choice you made. And as an adult, you know, you continue to, you know, to make choices that are going to inspire people and change people's lives. And that's it. That's why when I was telling you what this podcast is about, that's exactly what I want. I want, people are going to be listening to this, and they're you know, it's just given a measure of you. You know, we talked about, you know, building a community around you, you know, getting people on side. You know, the fact is, I pity any fighter that gets in the ring with you, because they don't have the fight that you have, because they've not been through this, you know, the same thing. I remember listening to somebody talking about a UFC, I think Dana White or somebody was talking, and they were saying, if you don't have the mindset for this, you know, if you're coming in here just because, you know, you think, oh, this is, you know, this is a bit of fun, you will get your head torn off, because there are people in there, your Mike Tysons of the world, you don't have what they've got, you know? Yeah. And I think your choice in that moment has undoubtedly changed the course of that kid's life. I mean, that kid will be how old now? Probably 14, 15?
Yeah.
Older than you were then?
Yeah, yeah. If, I mean, I seen the mum, and then I said, look, she was speaking Persian. I don't know whether she was from Iran or Afghanistan. So when I left that baby, you know, I was like, I was so grateful and thankful that I knew the mum was safe, and I knew the baby was safe.
Did you see the dad?
I didn't see the dad, but I just seen the mum, and then I just left it, and we started running away, you know, just...
Did you even know where you were running?
No, I didn't. The dinghy boat took us from Turkey to Greece, and we thought they said, oh, this is Greece, but we didn't know actually where we was. And we started running, and there was like a big hill. We started running up the hill, and then it seemed like the whole hill was surrounded by water, and everywhere we started going running up and then come back down on the other side, and it was water. Start running up again, come back down, and you see the water over there. So I just thought, what's going on here? I think we're in like a small little island, or where there is no way out. You know, you could literally die here. And then everybody started running. And then finally, when everybody got tired, everybody came back together, like literally every single one that started running, they all came back together, and they said, look, and there was a smart guy. They said, oh, look, we just have, all we have to do, there's lines, electric cables. We just have to follow that, and that will take us to shore. So I don't know how his mind worked. He must be genius, Einstein. And so we all started walking and taking this path to get to the shore. And then, funny enough, it did have a little pass that took us to the main village. And on that village, you could only see like a couple of houses. And then there was a church. there's a nice, beautiful, bear in mind, that's like 2 a.m. in the morning, dark, you can't see anything, everything's pitch dark, quiet. It's almost like out of that horror movie when you watch those horror movies. So we went in that church and we said, well, I've heard stories out whenever you go to a church, you know, the priest or whoever's in there or the nuns, they'll always welcome you and help you and feed you if you need be. So we went there and there was kids, you know, and I remember I can't picture the dad's face, but I know the mum was there and all the rest of the babies and everybody was there. So there was like a nice 2 orange trees and we were starving as anything. Everybody just jumped on that tree and started to like pick up those oranges. And it was one of the tastiest oranges ever. I can still taste it. It was good. And then I remember like vaguely like the dad and the mum kind of thanking me for helping them with the baby.
So the church, did you see a priest or nuns or anything? Did they?
No, we didn't see anybody. It was just too dark.
But you were able to stay in the church that night?
We weren't. Like, we were just outside and then everybody just kind of made their own way. They said, oh, we're going this way. Some said we're going that way. So there
How
was,
long had you been traveling with these people?
It was just that night. Just that night, that dinghy. Yeah. And then so I kind of, we were two of us and we just followed. There was another guy from Afghanistan and he was looked after us like as an older brother, you know, because he knew like we were very young. So we just literally followed him. Whatever he did, we did the same. I didn't have no money, no food, nothing. And that guy left us. And so there was only 2 of us left.
You and
there was another boy. So we was good friend on the way, you know, it was like very close and same age as well. He was a bit chubbier than me. I was very skinny. So during the night, we said, well, what are we going to do? We're going to freeze and we haven't got the right clothes and everything. And food, we're starving. We're going during the day. There was a little roundabout where it was like it was covered up with trees, all surrounded by trees and covered up like so the wind couldn't get in through. So we used to get inside that roundabout. And because it was just so cold, I mean, I don't know about him if I could keep him warm, but he certainly, that guy kept me warm. You know, I cuddled him. He had all the meat that you could possibly get. So I was just like, every time we used to go in the roundabout, we used to just cuddle up and go to sleep.
So how long were you there?
I think we were there about 15 days.
And what was the plan?
During the night, we were starving. During the night, we used to get up and walk across the road, you know, and see all those houses just went across. And they used to have these trees of apple tree or orange tree or pomegranate or whatever they had. So we used to kind of give piggyback to one another. And we tried to steal their fruit just because we couldn't, so we didn't have no food.
You were living just on fruit?
Literally 15, 16 days. That's how we lived, and that's all we used to do. And as soon as we heard a dog or somebody, we just used to leg it, just run as fast as you can. We just sat in that one park, and we were just starving, hungry. We didn't know what was happening, where are we going? No adults with us, no phone call, can't speak the language.
Did you speak to anybody there?
No, we didn't have anybody. And then there was very, very weird experiences along the way. Part of the journey where we were walking for days, you know, on the train track, and it was a desert. It was like a crossing from one country to another. I can't remember the country, but it was close to Greece. We were just going to another country. Yeah, we were walking and it was dead winter time. The snow's fallen and we haven't got the right shoes. And every time I step, my foot goes inside the snow and it's freezing. Literally, my foot was freezing. All the shoes were wet. We don't have no food. I'm starving. We've been walking for 2 days in this cold weather and we haven't got the right equipment. Or in fact, we haven't got anything, you know. So we crossed the border. I can't remember what it was. And then there's police. The police got us, you know. They took us to the police station. And it was very late at night. Again, it was around probably 12 to 1 or 2. And the outside, it was very cold. When we got into the police station, it was so warm. Just because we were walking for 2 days, as soon as I got inside the police station, I just couldn't keep my eyes open just because they had the heating on and everything. And it was just so nice. And it was literally, the police were searching us. and I was just dozing off asleep. One of the police shouted at me and then took me inside the other office, where again it was very warm, and I was just sat down there, and I seen there was like a roll of bread, you know, and I can remember, and it was like looking at it, and I just thought, oh, that bread would taste really nice, very nice. I just kind of want this police officer to offer me some. I'm starving and I can't keep my eyes open, and that's all I'm wishing for. I just want him to offer me some food. You couldn't find any horrible police officers than those guys. Literally didn't offer anything, shouting at us, overdose, knowing that we were only minors, screaming, and then put us back in the car, fingerprinted us and put us back in the car and brought us back halfway to the border, and then left us, and it's all snow. If we go back that way, it's like one day. If we go back backwards, it's another a day and a half, 2 days of walking. And he said, don't come back, and you just got to go back. And we're like starving. We're like, I think we're going to die here, man. We haven't got no food. We haven't got no clothes. And it's cold as anything. She's like, you know what? Let's start walking back. We can't go back this way. You know, so we started walking back. We walked about, I can't remember how many hours, but we seen this deserted train station. And we seen inside, it was almost like a horror movie. Every time I look at horror movie, it reminds me of that train station. And look inside there was like all the desks and chairs, the papers lying around, or you see all the dust and everything, and it's closed. It's literally abandoned train station. And on the other side, you can see there's abandoned trains and everything. And it was like very scary, dark at night. So we thought, it's just too cold outside here. We need some rest. So we got into those trains. It was just open. We got inside the train, and all of us. And then we said, it's just too cold. We need some warm. And
when you say all of us?
There was other guys, you know. Yeah. And once we got into this train, one guy had a lighter, and he smoked. So he had a lighter, and we put a fire inside the train, so you could just see the fire was there just to keep us warm. And I put my feet up. On that fire, I lifted my feet up and got it close to it and my hand, and I can't remember anything else. Because I was so tired, I just dozed off asleep. You know, my eyes got closed, and then the next thing, this guy wakes me up, wake up, your socks are on fire. You know, and I didn't even realize, just because you're walking for so many days on the snow, our feet got so numb, you know, couldn't feel anything. So my socks was on fire and I still could not feel anything. And so we just, took my socks out very quickly enough, you know. Yeah. I mean, the journey was hard.
The journey. I mean, how did you get to England from there then?
It was then, like, they've put us, we went back all the way, and the agent put us inside those big lorries. There was,
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Like inside the by the side of that big lorry, you see there's a fuel tank, the fuel tank, and they kind of put us inside that fuel tank. They had a little door outside. It's almost like the fuel tank inside it, they made a hole in there, and they kind of shoved us in there and to stay there.
There's no fuel in
driving.
There.
Like, no fuel in there, just like the two of us. And bear in mind, although I was very happy that this guy was chubby in the nighttime, but when we got inside that, I just could not breathe, just because my knee were touching my mouth. and he's the same. And this guy was big as well. He took all the space and we couldn't move. But there, we were like there 48 hours inside that lorry, and that lorry was traveling literally on the motorway, I don't know, 70 mile an hour. You could just see the road going really fast.
And I thought you could
just see that, you could just see the road and out. And if you kind of, if you switched off at any moment, and if you didn't have control over you and you kind of leaned towards your right, it would have been literally on the road and probably run over by another lorry or by another car.
Did you sleep?
No, we couldn't sleep. We had to kind of hold ourselves there, like both of us, literally one another, almost like in a box. But that one side of the box was open. If you put any pressure on towards your right, you would have been...
Would people have been able to see you from outside?
They wouldn't be able to see me from outside, but they would be able to see you from inside. If you get inside under the lorry, you could just see there. Yeah, and there.
That was going from wherever you were?
Greece to Italy.
Greece to Italy.
Greece to Italy, yeah.
And that was 2 days.
It was 2 days, yeah. Like just because of where we got into the lorry and how it got us all across, and then on the ferry.
Had you been given kind of an idea as to where to go? So you mentioned an agent. How's the agent involved in that?
You don't know how to get over, you know. It's the agents that know the route.
So is this somebody that your family, for instance, would have got in touch with?
It's somebody, yeah, your family gets in touch. And
you pay them, presumably.
And you pay them quite a lot of money to kind of get you across and guide you. And a lot of, like, it's almost like they never tell you the truth, and they don't care whether you die or whether you make it. To them, you're just another project, another making money project, the kind of... you make it great,
so then you're in Italy.
We were in Italy, and then in Italy there's like, again, can't speak the language, don't know what to do. And then we found this Afghan kid again who was very helpful, took us to his where he was living in a camp somewhere, and so he took us there and he showed us, go have a shower, and fed us proper well, looked after us really good, you know. And then he kind of came with us all the way to, you know, he showed us all around Italy.
You know where you were in Italy?
You know, I don't know, but I was in a couple of different cities. I wouldn't know where I was. I didn't even know Italy. And I can remember, the only thing I can remember about Italy, we were traveling on the train, and there was like, can't remember, there was something that was saying in 2012, on this day, at this time, the world is going to end. Somebody predicted, I can't remember.
The Mayans.
Yeah, and we were there, and I was thinking, and actually that, I heard that, and that was going through my mind as well. I just thought, oh, the world is going to end today. And there was another guy as well, we were talking to him, like the guy who's checking the tickets on the train, and the other guy was talking to me, said, oh, today's the world's going to end. What are you doing here? And he said, well, I still have to work. I still have to come to work, whether the world ends or not. That's the only time I remember, like, it's the highlight of Italy for me.
So then...
And then France, we were on the train backwards and forwards. I slept on the street with a couple of nights.
Did you know before making the journey, before starting the journey, that it was going to be this hard?
When I look as an outsider, and when I see... this journey from an outsider point of view, from, let's say, from a general guy, or from a teenager, or from another kid who's going to school here in England, to them, this journey is going to be absolutely impossible. It's very rare you can make it. It's the hardest journey you could make. But because I've seen stuff back home that, as again, I shouldn't have seen. Like, nothing really fazed me, you know. I knew the journey was hard. I knew, like, I just thought I was going to die. There was no emotions over my face, or I just thought, it is what it is. Nothing changes for me, because the same was in Afghanistan when I was back home. Like, I didn't know whether I was going to die or live. And I had one of my friends, like my close friend, childhood friends, and one where she had, he said, if I were to die, we were to die together, or if anything happened to us, I want us both to die together, like just die rather than get disabled or rather than lose an arm, lose something. Just like, that's it. Like, you want to die, we die together and it won't faze us. I'm happy with that. But like, I don't want to lose any of my arm or like, just because of, it's hard as it is with everything, with all your body part present, and
yeah,
to have to lose an arm or a leg or be disabled, that's going to be a next level difficulty that, yeah, it's not easy to cope with.
Was England always a destination? Did you leave Afghanistan?
No.
You just thought, I just need to be somewhere safe.
Yeah, I just need to be somewhere safe. I was in Belgium, I was underage, and I had a lot of trauma from back home. Any moment we could have died on that journey. I had a lot of issues or angers, I don't know, or energy that I needed to come out, you know, somehow. Like, you know, it was all internal, like it was inside me. And then I was in Belgium, and the Belgian police got me because I didn't have no paper or anything. And they put me in 24-hour cell and treated me really bad, kind of, in terms of like, I was a minor. I was like, just putting me in a cold room, just like, there's a toilet and there's just like a little box, you know, 24-hour. You can't do that to a child, you know, you can't do that.
Did they give you food?
They didn't give me no food or nothing. And I was like, I was in a stage, nothing fazed me. I couldn't sleep. I hit that door all night, kicked the door, like slammed it. And I said, look, please get me out of this. Get me out of this. I just can't stay here. And they just didn't do it. Like, they wouldn't. They said no.
Until, what was the point in holding you?
Yeah, I didn't have no paper. They could have, and they wouldn't explain it to me. When I would be released, or they wouldn't explain it to me, what's going to happen to me next, or what's going on, what's the process and everything. And they just put me there for 24 hours. After 24 hours, they got me out, fingerprinted me, and then they said, oh, you can stay in Belgium if you want, you know. And I thought, no.
You know, up to this point, not one authority has been kind to you.
No, absolutely not. No authority were kind to me. It was very kind of, it was almost like, what is this?
You know, yeah.
Where am I going? It was like, my journey hasn't ended. Like, I'm still on that. Like, I'm still protected. I've still got my guard up, like, all the time with whoever's in front of me. Regardless, I got my guard up just because of my journey and everything. We was in Calais trying to get on a lorry and trying to come to England. I didn't know anything. Like, I didn't know how it works, what happens. And there's people that, the agents, again, they do it for you, like opens the lorry and chucks you in there, whether it's a freezer lorry, whatever it is, all they care about, just chucking you in there and locking you in, hoping that, oh, you're going to stay alive and you're going to make it and get to the other side. It could take you back to Afghanistan. The lorry could take you anywhere. You don't know where the lorry is going. They put us the first time and it was like a biscuit lorry or something, and it was in there, we were starving, opened a few packet of biscuit.
Jenny, the best lorry you could have been in.
Yeah. And then, yeah, just like smashing it, you know.
How many do you reckon you ate?
A lot. I couldn't even move. And then when we got to the checkpoint, I think, so because you can't see outside, you're just inside the lorry, you're just kind of hearing the noise and everything. And the checkpoint stopped us and just opened the lorry and then got us all out, you know. So he's like, oh, okay, it's fine. So we had to go all the way back to where we started. And then the next time they found a freezer lorry and opened it. It was a dark night time. It opened it, put us in there. It was about, I can't remember how many, but roughly, let's say 7 or 8 of us. I thought, like in the back of my mind, I thought, and it was an orange lorry this time, food again, orange. You know, they used to do like orange. So I went right at the back of the lorry where the fan is, where it keeps the whole lorry or the container cool, you know, so nothing goes off. So I went right at the back and there was a few crates and everything. All the rest of the guys were at the front. So I went right at the back with another guy. So we went right close to the fan and then got a few crates of orange to kind of cover the lorry so they can't see that we are right at the end. So nobody, if the checkpoints comes up, they can't see. And so there was like the oranges and everything. So I was like, okay, let's start feeding. I I wasn't smart enough then. So I just started like peeling this orange and just downing it one after another, one after another. I'm like, it's super cold. It's a freezer lorry. It keeps everything freezing. Those oranges will freeze after like 40 minutes, an hour. I'm literally full up. I need to have a wee. On top of that, I'm freezing. I can't move my hands. My fingers are starting to kind of froze up and my body's like, oh.
How long was the journey?
It was like, again, I was probably in that lorry about 40 hours or something.
40 hours.
I thought I was going to die. I didn't think I could make it just because of the oxygen.
I just thought freeze to death.
And I was right at the back and I thought, oh, well, I'm right at the back. If I die, nobody knows. I'm dead, you know. It's like, oh, what's going to happen? I thought, it is what it is, you know, stay here. So I just stayed there. And then once we got to England, I can't remember, it was around Gloucester somewhere, the lorry stopped. It was just surrounding, you know, by Cotswold. That's all I can remember is it was around Gloucester. As soon as they opened the door, everybody, all those other guys, the adults, they all jumped out and started running away. I was literally froze. I couldn't move. So I had to almost push myself, fall off the lorry rather than jump, just because I couldn't, my hands and feet, everything was frozen. So I fell off. And then, yeah, once off the lorry, it was very different feeling. It was like, what now?
What did the guy say? Did he talk to you all?
The lorry driver, yeah. He started running. He just thought, oh, what's going on? He got proper scared. I was the last. Yeah, it is. I was the last, so I fell off. And then everybody started running, the guys. But I just didn't know what to do. So I just started walking. You know, I started walking. I had like €50 on me.
Where did you get that from?
Do you remember the guy that was in Italy? You know, I think he's very nice. He fed us and stuff. The Afghan kid, he kind of gave him the money. Oh. So it was very kind of him. So I had that money, like €50 with me. Like I just thought, you know.
Useless here. Literally, absolutely useless here.
I was walking literally by the docks, across the docks. If you see that zebra cross right where it takes you to town. So as I came across and there was seen a bus stop, I am in town. And I think that bus was going to Quaisley or somewhere. I thought, I need to get on that bus so it could take me to town or it could take me some. I think it was jeans. But like, because along the journey, I lost a lot of weight. So it was like proper baggy jeans. And the T-shirt was like proper baggy, dirty, as you can imagine, just not having shower for days and days. Yeah, so I seen the bus stop and I thought, oh, I'm gonna try again in there. And so I seen everybody going inside the bus and kind of giving them the money and the bus driver takes him. So I go inside the bus and I gave him the euro. And that guy just looked at me and started like, what are you doing? Get out. He's like, literally, go on, get out. And I said, okay. So I knew what he meant. So I just got out the bus. And so I walked back and stood by that zebra crossing. I just thought, I don't know what's happening. Like,
so you're alone now?
Like, I'm alone.
Is that the first time you were alone?
There was other times I was alone, but like, it was very weird feeling. It was just like, I was stood, but I wasn't present.
Mm.
You know, I wasn't present within myself. Like, I was far away. I didn't know where I was. So I just stood there, just like staring at the road, right standing next to the road. And I was just staring at the road and I was just there for probably 20 minutes, good 20 minutes. And the next thing I see, this police car comes right next to me. I didn't even know how they knew. They stopped. All they did, opened their car. I can't remember anything they said. I don't even know if they spoke. Stopped their car. There's a nice, very nice lady, opened the car. I didn't even say a word. I just got in there inside the car because I was froze. Literally, I was froze. As soon as I got inside that car, it was like so warm, so warm.
Do you know what time of year this was?
You know, it was February time.
February.
Yeah.
So you've done all of this through the freezing cold winter months.
And then when I got inside, I couldn't keep my eyes open again just because it was just so warm. I was cold and suddenly hit by this warm. That was the first time ever anybody or any authorities being nice to me was that woman. I can still remember her, you know, and she offered me like a biscuit from there. And I just thought, oh, thank you. That was the highlight of my journey kind of thing in here in England. Like that was my journey couldn't have ended any better. You know, it couldn't have ended any better. It was like, you know, when you say the icing on the cake, and I think that woman was, you know.
Do you know who she is?
I can't remember. I don't know her name.
This would have been, what, 12 years ago?
Like, I felt comfortable.
You feel safe?
I felt safe. First time I dropped my guard and I felt safe, even though, like, I was on my way, I was feeling tired, I was dozing, but I never allowed myself to fall asleep.
Again, I think we need to remember that you couldn't speak English at this time. I mean, you know, your English is fantastic now. Like, really is. Really, but you couldn't speak a word of English, and this is the first time that you felt safe.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
of this lady.
Although I couldn't speak English, but her gestures and her facial expression, you know, like, it was so kind, and I just knew I would be safe. Like, I'm going to be safe. So I just, yeah, just dozed off there, like, after the biscuit, obviously.
Yeah. And then did she take you to the station then?
And then she took me to the station, and then they did all the fingerprints and a few questions and stuff. And then because I'm...
Did they have a translator?
Because I was a minor, they gave me into a foster home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I see nowadays, I see all these kids or all these guys treating police or behaving or swearing or whatever and being very disrespectful to the police. And then they say, oh, they're this, they're that. But like, I haven't had any experiences like that with them. Like, it was amazing, you know.
Here.
It was great here, you know. That's why I have very, very high respect for the authority and for the police.
So they were all kind to you in the station?
They were amazing. Amazing.
Incredible. And so from the station, did you go straight away to a foster home or what was the...
I had to do a few checks and everything, but they fed me. That was the most important thing.
you'd have a sleep.
Literally, because I was so hungry, my body was craving so much food because I haven't had it along my journey. I haven't had that. Like, they gave me a dinner, like a food. I had that, and then 5 minutes later, I was hungry again, and I just said, I'm hungry again. Like, and they bought another one. I said, I'm hungry again. And they bought another one. So it's like, it's amazing, you know. It's like, it was incredible. But I just kept eating. I just couldn't stop. Even, I don't know if I was hungry or I didn't know if it was a mental barrier. Like in my head, I might have been thinking like, oh, this is the time where I can fuel up. I don't know when I'm going to have the food next.
That might have been that.
So it could have been that. So I just kept eating until they said, that's it. We had enough of you. We're going to give you into a foster home. So yeah.
The foster home, did you move around foster homes? Or?
Yeah, like there was a temporary foster home until they kind of found me a permanent foster home.
How long did that process take?
Took about 6-7 months, and then finally,
lots of displacement again.
Yeah,
lots of moving around families. How did you find that?
Again, you know, like every time I had my guard up all the time, just because of my journey, because of everything else, I never kind of dropped my guard. And then finally, when I got into Anne's home, you know, when we started living there, never again. I had always my guard up until I knew, and she worked through hardship with me, and I knew she was a genuine, nice and kind person. She was there to help me and she was there to support me in whatever way she could. Only then I started to trust her and I started to kind of drop my guard. And
how long would you say that took?
Relax. You know, it took me a long time, very long time. Like even now, I still like, I trust everybody, you know, I'm very kind and very helpful with anyone, but I'm still very kind of I still have that safety thing with me. Like I have to know you to trust you fully, so I always have my guard up. Like even just because of my journey, sometimes people disguise, tell us they're someone, but in reality they're someone else, you know. So yeah, you just never know what's what.
Did it help that she and McDonald, we should say, had fostered other Afghan kids as well?
She fostered another Afghan kid. I don't know. I think because my journey was very different to the other Afghan kid. I was very different. And she still says it to this day. He said, you're very different, you know, to not in any other way, but it was just like I was in my own journey. I was on another road. I had another path. And there were some struggles along the way. And she had to work to find me, you know, and she had to know that my journey was different. And yeah, she had to kind of find different ways of making me feel relaxed and making me trust her. Yeah. And and she did that amazingly. She's done absolutely an amazing job. She turned me from a boy into a young man. And like, as again, you know, there is nothing wrong with me, but however, you know, mentally, when you go through a lot of stuff like that, trauma and everything, you still need somebody to kind of heal you and help you go through those emotions. Anne has done a lot, and she's helped me a lot. She's turned me from a young boy into a young man. I had so much energy. I put it into, like, I was doing studying. Like, when I got into school, I couldn't speak English. So all I did was, from the morning, go to school. And in my break time, I used to go and study. In my lunchtime, I used to go and study. And then when I got home, I didn't do anything else. I just got home and started to read and write. I couldn't read or write. So I just, like, those kids' book, you know, the toddler's book. I was trying to read those and trying to see if I could pronounce those words correctly and see if I could make sense of it all. And then that's what I did, like, all the time, like, for months and months and months. And all the other kids she fostered, or the Afghan kids or anyone else, they used to come in, drop their bag off to the park and play with their mates or do other stuff, where I was just, like, in the house, just go to school, study, come home, study. I would finish, like, 11 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night. There was a point I was in one of my foster family, half nine o'clock at night. She used to turn everything. She says, bedtime, you have to go to bed. So we said, okay, so no problem. So because I couldn't sleep during the night, and because of my journey, I was like, I was staying awake, wide awake. There's so much stuff going through my head. I had a big window, the room. So I used to put the light on, and I used to try pronounce those toddler's books and stuff, try to read it, you know, just try to keep my mind busy. And she used to come, my first family used to come in and turn the light off. And she used to say, you can't keep the light on. You got to go to sleep. You can't stay awake. It's like 10 o'clock at night, and I used to say, I can't sleep. So then I found a cheap, like, a Tenaphone from Asda. You know, my social worker got me. So I used to put the light on that phone. And then I used to read. I still have them at home. I used to have that cheap phone where you kind of press the same button three times to get that one letter. And then I used to try type all those words and everything on that phone. And then the next day I used to delete it all and repeat again.
That's amazing.
Delete it all, repeat again. And then when I got to Anne's, she seen me do that for months and months. And then she said, it's not healthy. You can't do that. You just can't go to school and come back. And, you know, it was like, you can't do that. We have to find you something. I said, don't know. Like, what else?
This is all you, this is your life,
this
right?
is all
your
I school. Do. Like, I don't know what to do.
Were you making friends at school, or how did you find that?
It was okay. Like, I was, everybody was nice, and, like, everybody were friendly to me, and I was friend, but I was always, because I wasn't mixing, I wasn't playing around. I was just, like, going in, just do my thing, just study and stuff, trying to learn. So that's why I didn't really have fun during school, to be honest. But then whoever used to come in, and if they couldn't speak English, or if there was anybody that needed help in that way, so I was there to kind of help them.
Be a mentor for them as well.
Being a mentor, because I knew what it felt like to be that guy, to walk into a school and not being able to speak the language, or not knowing what to do and
how
to do it. St. Peter's. Yeah.
Big old school.
Oh, it's a great school. Amazing. The teachers are amazing. It's an incredible school. I always tried to mentor, but otherwise, yeah, that's all I did. Just study until, yeah. And my first mom, until she said, "Love, you know what?" She told my other foster brother, you know, this guy is, it's not healthy what he's doing. We got to find him something. you know, he needs to get some energy out, get some whatever he's got. He needs something. So we tried kickboxing for a little bit, and it was just wasn't really the same. I remember coming into boxing with my foster brother. He came in first time with me. He wanted to box, and he was very good at that time. Won the first day, got punched in the face. I don't know what happened, and I just thought, that's it. This is it.
I found my thing.
Yeah, and then from the second day, my brother said, actually, I'm done, I ain't going. Like, he didn't really, he had other stuff, so I'm going. So I just kept going. Couldn't speak English, you know. So I kind of almost developed in the gym, made friends. Just loved it, you know, getting punched in the face, punching people, just training hard, you know, being just like, in a sense, being tortured, putting through those hard stuff, you know. Ever since, my training went from 2 days to 3 days, from 3 days to 5 days, and then full time. And then I started going running, you know, outside the gym, go run from 2 miles, first time ever to run from 2 miles, going into slowly 4 miles, and then doing 10 miles, you know. And now it's like, look at me now,
yeah.
Just a full time professional boxer.
It's still absolutely incredible.
Still at it.
It really is. Tell me about John.
Oh, John's amazing. He was there, like, I mean.
So this is John Pittman. Sorry, we should say John Pittman, yeah, at Fight Factory.
John Pittman from Fight Factory. He's been great. Great hub. He kind of, I can remember having a conversation with him in the old gym. That was like about 9 years ago, roughly. And I said, back then I was schooling then. So I spoke to him and I said, how much should I put into this training? You know, and what do you think about professional boxing? Do you think, like, can we make it? Should I put all my focus in boxing, or should I do the schooling and everything? And he said, yeah, if you put your mind to it, you can achieve it, you know, absolutely. He said, but you can't put all your eggs in one basket, as they say. And I was always like, in my head, I always had that in the back of my mind, like, should I go for a career? Should I go, like, what everybody else does, like, get a job and stuff and schooling, uni and everything, or should I just box? Should I do that? Should I box? It drove me nuts, because I wanted to do both. Whatever I do, I want to do it to the best of my ability. So I just thought, you know what? I'm going to do both. I did my schooling, went to college, and then from college, go do my apprenticeship, you know, and then go to uni, do my degree, and then at the same time, building my boxing. And I see everybody says, oh, it's hard, you can't do it, it's absolutely impossible. But
you're making it work.
You know, and it's working for me, and it worked. I had the last, literally, I had my exams. I had seven assessments out all at the same time. And then I had my dissertation and everything. And then I also had 2 fights lined up. I had to train for both of the fights. I had a full training camp. I had to reduce my calories. I was hungry. I had to train hard, do sprints, do sparring, get punched in the face. It was hard. It's not easy. It's very hard when you're dieting and training. And then on top of that, you haven't got no energy or anything. And then on top of that, I had to go and do my uni work. I had to.
Because you've just finished uni.
I just finished uni, yeah, yeah.
So what were you doing at uni?
Sports strength and conditioning, yeah.
Is that because, obviously it's a passion of yours?
Yeah.
Is it something that you want to have as a career beside your pro boxing now, until a point at which you don't?
This is good. It is, like, I mean, sport is my career.
It's your life.
I love it. It is my life. Everything I do evolves around sport. When I get up, what I eat, where I go, who I meet, what I do, what I think ahead, everything evolves around sport, really. So strength and conditioning was like a great choice. I love learning about my body, it worked both ways. One, I got my degree, my education. 2, that is going to give me, it's going to help me see my road in a lot of different ways, and it's going to help me train hard, but also train smart, you know, and to get to where I want to get to those world titles. Yeah.
Take a second just to look back at how far you've come in 12 years. You've got a degree in a language that, you know, you came here not knowing. You know, you're a professional boxer. It is truly inspirational. It's incredible. You know, I've said to other people, I don't want this podcast to be too, you know, I don't want to take myself too seriously with it or anything like that. But I think a story like yours deserves to be told in the way you've just done it. So thank you for that. And I know that you've got so much more to do. when do you want to start fighting for the titles? Like, what's, if you could ideally be fighting, would it be, is it within 12 months? Is it 24 months? Is it 5 years? What are the next few years look like for you?
The titles, definitely. The titles are coming. I can see my road. Like, although I didn't know whether, like, I didn't know, am I going to get here? Am I going to be a professional boxer? Am I going to win my fight? Am I even going to get the titles? Am I going to make it to the top? That's all questions. You know, there's so many questions that needs to be answered. I just seen like along my journey in life generally, I just seen like one thing I've learned. All I need is a little indicator, and then I'm on that journey, regardless of whether I can see the front or I can't see. As long as I've got light right at the end of the tunnel, as long as I can see that light, I'm gonna march towards it, and no matter what route I'm going to take to get there, but I am going to get there. I'm not going to give up. And I think my ambition for the world title is one of those. That's my light. That is that light in the tunnel for me. I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't know the difficulties that lies ahead for me, but I can see it. I can see it in my mind, and even more so now than I did before. I can see it, and it's getting closer. Like, I can just feel it within myself. It's going to happen. You know, I can see it. So all I have to do is just stay dedicated, stay humble, train hard, focus on my boxing, get the right team around me, get my whole town.
Let's bring Gloucester behind you.
Get my Gloucester behind me, you know, get my people behind me. Yeah, hopefully we'll get there. I think I'll be the first person to bring that world title to Gloucester. And I will do it. I will do it. You know that.
I believe you. Kings, I completely believe you.
We have the rugby ground at the King's Home. I'm going to fill that for my world title one day. So that is the goal and that is the dream. It's going
to
happen.
What does success look like to you?
Do you know, over the years, the meaning of success has changed to me so many times. But now, like, what success looks like to me, being healthy is one, being healthy and being happy.
What does happiness look like?
Doing what I love, being around who I love, doing what I want to do, you know, I just be who I am, you know, like, I'm very happy right now. Like this, I'm success. Like, I don't know, like, some people tally success with financial side, but like I've learned different through my journey and stuff. That's meaningless to me. You know, my success is what I've worked hard for. You know, like, as I said now, like that world title to me, like you can buy that belt if you wanted to buy a belt like that. If somebody tomorrow gave me like a world title belt and said, look, you don't have to fight for it. Here is the world title. You've got it. You're a world champion in your weighted category. I would say, what's this? I don't want this. That's not what I want. It's that journey along, and I need to enjoy the journey. And I'm enjoying it more and more. The difficulties, the happiness, the ups and downs, meeting different people, building my team, making friends. Yeah, just experiencing the journey. That's what happiness is. Just enjoying every moment of life.
That's what I mean. I've got no doubt that you succeed and that you get every happiness you deserve, because honestly, I want to see it for you. And I know everybody around you wants to see it for you as well.
Thank you. I think Gloucester is definitely getting behind me for sure. I need to put myself out there more and more for sure. I'm just building right now. I'm just building my team. Every day by day, my team is getting stronger and stronger. I have John Pittman, absolutely like a great, great coach, great guy there to help you whatever way he can. And then I have my strength and conditioning coach. Everything happens for a reason. I went to uni. I finished my degree. I met my strength and conditioning coach there, Edward Baker. Absolutely the best in the business. I couldn't fault it. You know, I can just see my training going into another level every time, day by day, like my boxing ability. We're going sparring, me and John, and going to different gyms. And I can just see myself like going all the way to the top just because I see all those other prospects and stuff. And I'm able to spar those guys and I'm able to feel comfortable. And I think, like, is that all?
Have you been tested yet?
No, I haven't. And that's yet to be found out, as I said before. Like, I've had hard sparring for sure, but one that needs to test me, I haven't been tested yet. So that's a question I just need to make. I need to find somebody who's going to answer that for me.
I remember coming to watch you in, was it Hatherley Manor?
Yeah, my first fight.
In your first fight. I remember coming to watch that and just thought, everybody always says it, but it is that X factor. It's like, oh, you've got it. You don't know what it is, but you could see it. And everybody there that night, I think, thought the exact same thing. Like, and it's just wonderful to see. And as I say, I watch, you're fantastic on your social media. You give a lot and it's all great quality stuff, which is, it's a skill in itself. And it's part of, you know, it's a job in itself, isn't it, sometimes? But I think you do a fantastic job of that. But I love, and I know other people do, and other people will, especially after this, they'll just love to see your journey continue. It, you know, it didn't start in the kindest way for you. You know, you've really grasped the opportunities and made opportunities, and we as a city should be incredibly proud of you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be part of it. This is my home. You know, this is home to me. You know, Gloucester. I can't imagine myself being calling any other place home. You know, I spent half of my life in Afghanistan and half of my life here. Like, I came here when I was 12, and I'm 24 now. So, like, I'm Afghan, part of me, you know, but I'm also, you know, Gloucester boy. So spent half my life here, I'm sure. And people have supported me in Gloucester, and I think they will continue to support me. I've got some sponsors. I appreciate all their help and what they do for me, you know.
It's all just positivity. I think that's what it is. It's you put out positivity, positivity comes back to you. And it will only continue as you progress. Is there anything you'd say to somebody that is in a position where they're struggling in life?
Surround yourself with good people. That's key. Just take one step at a time. Take 1 minute at a time, 1 hour at a time, 1 day at a time, 1 week, and then month and year at a time. But still, whatever your dream is, just get one step closer to it. Just get 1 second closer to it, or 1 day closer to it. One step at a time. I'm going to do it. Whatever happens, I'm going to do it.
Going to do it all.
I'm going to do all. I'm going to do it.
Well, your positivity is genuinely infectious. I think it's amazing that you, after everything, are the person you are. So just thank you for coming. Thank you for speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you going through.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks a bit. I told you it was a good one, didn't I? Shabir is an incredible, incredible young man with a phenomenal future. And although his name might not be the best known of the names that you're going to see in this series, it's one you should remember. And that's what I want to do with this podcast. I want a mix of people you've possibly heard of that draw listeners and have their own incredible story to tell, and then successful, driven, optimistic, positive people like your Shabirs of the world that you might not have heard of, but now you have. Hopefully you won't forget his name. You can follow Shabir on Facebook, or just search The Afghan Warrior. You can follow him on Instagram at Shabir Haidery. In fact, I'll drop all of the social links into the notes below the episode. And you can do me a massive, massive favor. Let's keep this podcast, let's keep this interview podcast going up the charts. Go and review it if you liked it. 5 stars, please. That would be wonderful. Tell your friends, share the podcast, subscribe. Subscribe on more than one. If you've got Spotify, if you've got Apple Podcasts, go and subscribe on more than one. Let's really get it up those charts. Let's get these conversations out there. I think it's incredibly important to get this optimism, this positivity, this resilience out there, and show that no matter what your starting line is, and that's the whole point of this, no matter what your starting line is, there's a way forward, and you can keep a smile on your face. You can keep moving forward, and that's incredibly powerful, I hope, to some of you listening. Again, you can follow us at Starting Line Show on Instagram and TikTok, Starting Line Show without the W on Twitter, and if you search The Starting Line Podcast on Facebook, you'll find us there too. Find out more about me and about the podcast itself at startinglinepod.com, or you can email us hello@startinglinepod.com. It's been really nice getting a few messages from listeners, so keep those coming. If you've got guest suggestions, if you're a manager or somebody indeed that thinks that
their stories are one that we should get out there through this podcast, then get in touch again, hello@startinglinepod.com. Always, always lovely to hear from people. Thank you again. This is turning into something quite exciting. It's amazing to think that we are just 3 weeks since I pressed the button on the Levi Roots episode, and already we're charting, already we're making some headlines. It's just phenomenal, and I can't wait to see where this goes. I don't think there's any reason that this can't get to number one. Why not? Let's see what kind of guests we can get. Let's see what kind of stories we can tell. Thank you again for coming along on this with me. Thank you to producer Eddie. Thank you to my girlfriend Vic, who is the person behind the jingle you hear at the beginning and end. I can never get it out of my head. So thank you, Vic. And thank you to Rami and his team that put together the promo videos as well. If you haven't looked at them, they're just fantastic. I absolutely love seeing them every week. They listen to the episodes, they pull out the best quotes, they turn it into something pretty special. So thank you. Thank you. Keep listening. Keep smiling. Keep moving forward. Until next time, when we've got another incredible guest.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.